The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library and to the lecture which my family and I endowed in honor of my father, Ellis Wax. My name is Margie Weingarten, and I'm a proud supporter of the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation. The Free Library carries out critical work each day to advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity in our community. Please consider making a gift of support to the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation. Visit freelibrary.org/support to learn more. It is now my pleasure to introduce the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, A. Scott Berg. He is renowned for his detailed portraits of American icons, including the National Book Award-winning biography, Max Perkins, Editor of Genius, An Exploration of the Famed Editor and the Literary Giants He Nurtured, and Lindbergh, which chronicled Charles Lindbergh's 1927 one-man transatlantic journey, turning that historic flight into a narrative tour de force. Drawing from newly discovered papers and previously unknown events, his new book, Wilson, casts a fresh light on the life of our 28th president, 100 years after his first inauguration. The Miami Herald calls Wilson an absorbing look at a formative period in American history and a magnanimous appraisal of an uncommon leader whose controversial idealism resounds to this day. John Rossi of the Philadelphia Inquirer deems Berg's biography by far the best single study of Wilson's life and times. Inquirer also reported that Leonardo DiCaprio has signed to produce and star in a film based on Berg's Wilson. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming A. Scott Berg.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. Some have asked why I haven't appeared here before. It's my first visit to the Philadelphia Free Library. The answer is quite simple. Nobody ever invited me. So I'm really glad you all finally got around to it, because it's a genuine pleasure to be here. It's an honor. Thank you very much. So we are going to talk tonight about the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson. But more to the point, what I'd like to talk about is the man who became the 28th President of the United States. And it's something I've tried to convey in my biography of Wilson. It's something I try to convey in all my biographies that I've done, which is the human side of the character. And what I try to do is use that to illuminate the professional side, that which they became famous for. And in the case of Wilson, it's an extremely interesting story, because people knew very little about Woodrow Wilson, the man. And that is what I want to talk a little about tonight, and what, as you will see in the book, it's what it's all about, because they are together. They are welded. You can't really separate them. So I thought I would begin by telling you a little about how I got here, how I got to Woodrow Wilson. I began writing biography, I guess, when I was in college, when I wrote my senior thesis on Max Perkins, and that, when I graduated, the English department of Princeton passed it back to me and said, well, this isn't really a senior thesis. It's really the first draft of a book. What we'd like you to do is transpose this thesis into a book, if you would, which sounded great because I didn't want to go to law school. So that was a wonderful idea. But what they failed to tell me was it would take another 7 years to do that. Now, while I was in about year two of this project of transposing thesis into a book, I began to develop an idea that I've been nurturing ever since, which is, wouldn't it be interesting, I asked myself, to write not just a book, but to write a shelf full of books about 20th century American cultural figures. And each one is going to be from a different part of the country, and each one is going to be from a different slice of the apple pie. So indeed, my first book was about an East Coast, Harvard-educated, ninth-generation white Anglo-Saxon Protestant who went into publishing and basically changed the course of the great river we call American literature. My second book, I went to the opposite coast. I went to the Pacific side of this country. I found an East European teenage runaway who was an illegal alien named Shmuel Gelbfish, who had run away from Warsaw, Poland, and in a matter of years changed his name to Samuel Goldwyn and invented something we now call Hollywood. So that was him. Then my eyes turned to the Midwest. I was looking for a great Midwestern figure, somebody who kind of captured that essence of America. And I began to think, what are the great metaphors of 20th century America? And of course, the airplane immediately came to mind. Who is the great romantic embodiment of the airplane? And I, well, just all roads kept leading to Lindbergh. And indeed, I set out to write about Lindbergh. And in this case, it took me a year to get permission from the widow Lindbergh, the immortal Anne Morrow Lindbergh, who granted me the permission to actually break her husband's will and give me permission to go into his papers. She gave me a letter, and I urge you all to go to ascottberg.com, where if you do, I have a very zippy website now, by the way, but if you go to the Lindbergh section and push archives, you will see the copy of the handwritten letter Anne Morrow Lindbergh gave to me. So if you Anne Morrow Lindbergh groupies, it's something you will really like, I think. And make no mistake about it, she has groupies, I know, and deservedly so. In any case, I'll just tell you briefly, just now that we're on Lindbergh for one moment. When I went up to the library to see how voluminous the archives were, because I thought, gee, am I going to be here for a few weeks, a few months? What is it going to be? And I said to the librarian who took me down to the cage where they were held, you know, there was this whole room just filled with shelves and shelves of blue boxes. And I said, well, how much of these are Lindbergh's? And the librarian said, those. The truth is, I then went outside the library, I sat on a bench, and I wept because I knew it was going to be 2 years of work, and with apologies to any Yaleys, I knew I was going to be in New Haven for 2 years. And not a pretty thing. In any case, after that book, I parenthetically did a personal memoir of my friend of 20 years, Katharine Hepburn, but then I got back to my plan, my long-term plan of writing this apple pie. And I began to think about the South, which I had not written about, and I began to think about politics and government, which I had not written about. And even it occurred to me higher education, which I thought was a powerful force in this country and certainly in its development in the 20th century. And I had not written about that. And all roads in this case were turning to somebody whose name, in fact, I had in my hip pocket. And it was somebody I had been reading about, caring about, thinking about since I was 15 years old. And true confessions, and I'll give you the other true confession, which is that I watch The Bold and the Beautiful every day, which I've been doing for 27 years while I write, because it's a big break in the action. But my other dark truth, my other confession is that at 15 years of age, I read a book on Woodrow Wilson and, well, fell kind of in love, you know. And by the time I was 15 and a half, I had a poster of Woodrow Wilson up on my wall. I am sure I'm the only kid on the block who did. But wherever I have been for the rest of my life, a picture of Woodrow Wilson has invariably hung over my desk. And he has never been far from my thoughts. And now, here we are tonight. So, let's break a little ground and let me talk a little about Woodrow Wilson. Also, if you want to win a bet in a bar, bet on this. What was Woodrow Wilson's first name? And they'll all say Woodrow, you know, but this is not who's buried in Grant's tomb. He was born Thomas Woodrow Wilson, and he was known as Tommy until he graduated from college, in fact. And there was something, just a parenthetical thought here. There was something so touching to me when I was going through Wilson's archives, and he would get a letter from one of his old classmates in college. He's president of the United States. He's the mightiest man on earth. And the letter is, "Dear Tommy." You know, anyway. Here is why I wrote a book about Woodrow Wilson. I'm running tonight on a platform with two planks. The first is this. I believe Woodrow Wilson is the most influential figure of the 20th century. I believe he changed life more than any single person. If you don't believe me, read my book. Or listen up for a few minutes, or read the first chapter of my book. And if I don't get you there, then fine. I don't want to know you. But the second reason, and this I am on very firm ground, I truly believe that Woodrow Wilson's personal story, was the most dramatic ever to unfold in the White House. Some of you may know a little about it, most of you know nothing about it. And that's great, because I want you to have an experience that may excite you as much as it excited me as it began to reveal itself a little bit as I was growing up from 15 to 25 to 35, well, and so forth, and even more during the last 13 years when I was researching this life, because I realized that one of the reasons Woodrow Wilson has fallen into some disfavor in the last few years, one of the reasons people don't really know much about him, one of the reasons people don't appreciate that 100 years ago, or more to the point, in 1918, when Woodrow Wilson left this country, became the first United States president to leave U.S. soil, and went to Paris to negotiate the peace, which he did for 6 months. The president of the United States left the country for 6 months. But when he arrived in Paris, he was greeted not as a great leader, not as a great military hero. He was greeted as the savior of the world. It was that simple. Those were the phrases he used. I mean, the Pope came out to see him in Rome. It was like that. Woodrow Wilson was, at that point, the most celebrated man on earth. And the hopes of the entire world were on his shoulders. And so it's amazing to me how little he is either known or thought of in this moment. Now, part of that is we live in a kind of dumb age in which anything that happened more than 5 years ago, we just don't know about. And certainly, if it isn't on television, we don't have a clue. But this is somebody everybody, I believe, should know about. And so I want to talk a little about this fusion, you see, of the personal life with the professional life, which, again, I don't think you can separate. And I think the more one knows about who Woodrow Wilson was as a man, the more that will inform what you know about his presidency, which, as I've already made clear, influenced the entire 20th century more than anyone else's personal life, you see. So here we go. I think the best way I can deal with this in a limited amount of time is to throw some bullet points at you and basically give you some things to take away with you tonight. And in so doing, maybe you'll begin to see some of the links between the personal Woodrow Wilson and the professional Woodrow Wilson, the political Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was the first Southerner elected to the White House since the Civil War. This was a big deal. He was born in 1856 in Virginia. He remembered the Civil War. Woodrow Wilson's first memory growing up in Augusta, Georgia, before his family moved to South Carolina and North Carolina. So this is a boy who grew up in four states of the Confederate States of America. So Woodrow Wilson's first memory, when he was not yet 4 years old, was in November of 1860, when Abraham Lincoln was elected president of the United States. And little Tommy Wilson remembered people chatting all about the town. Lincoln has been elected. There's going to be a war. And Wilson, Tommy Wilson, carried that with him for the rest of his life, especially as he saw the war that broke out, especially as he saw people he knew being killed, when he saw his father's church, where Joseph Wilson was the Presbyterian minister in Augusta, Georgia, when he saw that church being turned into a hospital, where he saw neighbors coming back from the war maimed, where people were really suffering during the war, where there was a shortage of food, where there was a shortage of clothing. Wilson really understood what privations of war meant. He carried this with him for the rest of his life. Needless to say, this is going to inform judgments he makes when there's a movement afoot to bring the United States into the First World War. So you can't really separate this stuff, you see. Now, to move on, Woodrow Wilson became the most educated president in American history, before or since. He is the only American president with a doctorate degree. He went off to Princeton in the 1870s. He graduated in 1879 from Princeton. It was a small school in the middle of New Jersey, largely Presbyterian. A Presbyterian minister's son fit in on one hand, but on the other hand, he was something of a misfit. He was a rather unworldly young man, and he was suddenly thrown onto this playground with the sons of some of the richest men, not just in the country, but in the world. And if you think of the famous wealthy families of the 19th century, most of them had some family member attending Princeton at that time. And Wilson already, as a teenager now, began to see great inequities in American society. And needless to say, this rubbed him the wrong way because he was something of an outsider there. He was basically a kid who, at one point, wanted to send a postcard home, a penny postcard, to write his parents to send more money. And he literally had to shake the couch because he thought he remembered once dropping a penny into the back of a couch. And he found it, and the postcard was sent, you see. So he was bailed out a little. But Wilson, after Princeton, was already harboring political dreams. And Wilson thought, well, at this point, his highest aspiration was to become a United States senator. And he wanted to be a senator from the state of Virginia because he thought, well, he's silly. Here I am in Philadelphia. He thought that was the cradle of the United States, you see. But, of course, he was a Virginian, so what else is he going to think? But he also thought the path to a political career was to have a law degree, and so he attended the University of Virginia Law School. He didn't care for law school very much, and he left in his second year, and he went to Atlanta, which was then something of a boomtown, where he opened up a little practice. Woodrow Wilson was a terrible lawyer. He in 2 years, got no clients. I mean, none. He was just no good at it. He just didn't know how to do it. He didn't know how to rustle up. He was no rainmaker, you know. And so what Wilson spent most of his days doing was just sitting and reading and taking notes. He was writing lots of essays, political essays. This interested him a great deal. He was fascinated by the British parliamentary system. So he wrote lots on this, read lots on this, and really was ready to throw in the towel. One gig came his way. He got one real job, which his mother sent to him. And it was, there was some family property that needed some contracts drawn up. And so Ma Wilson said to Tommy Woodrow, why don't you go to Rome, Georgia, and settle this estate and so forth, which he did. And there, this Presbyterian minister's son met the Presbyterian minister's daughter of Rome, Georgia. And he fell instantly and madly in love with this woman, Ellen Louise Axon. And she was a beauty, and I've got some just gorgeous pictures of her in the book, as you will see. So even if you don't read the book, just look at the pictures of Ellen. She's really sweet. This is after, I should tell you, that he tried to propose marriage to his first cousin, who did turn him down. And she was no beauty, as you can also see in the book. But not to be too superficial about it. In any case, Wilson now, realizing he's in love, wants to get married, but of course he has no career. He's a terrible lawyer, so what is he to do? Well, he does have one passion in life, short of politics, which he believes he cannot have a career in, because now in the late 19th century, Wilson is of the belief that you need money, you need prestige, you need family background to have a political career. And so he took a leap into academia. And he decided he always loved school, and so he went to Johns Hopkins, where he became one of the first graduate students there, where he studied a brand new discipline called political science. And Woodrow Wilson became one of the first political scientists in this country. And there he was in the 1880s studying in Baltimore. And while he was finishing up his degree, now married or just about to get married, he got a job offer. And he got a job offer up here from Bryn Mawr College, which had not opened its doors yet. And Woodrow Wilson became a member of the first cohort of professors at Bryn Mawr. And literally, he was there the rainy afternoon when they opened the school, when it was little more than two buildings standing there. And he began a very important and serious academic career. With all due respect, he didn't like being at Bryn Mawr College. It wasn't much of a campus. It was brand new. How to put this politely, it was teaching all women. And this was, at that point, something of a novelty, teaching women in college. This was quite amazing. And Wilson really had about 6 to 12 students. He taught history, he taught political science, he taught economics. It was sort of a little of everything that we would now call poli-sci. And there he was. And he wasn't that beloved a teacher because really his distaste for being there became somewhat evident. A lot of people, some of his students, some of his very smart female students, didn't like him because they found his Southern attitudes, especially toward race, a little backward even. I mean, Wilson was playing the game up north now, and attitudes were quite different. But there he was, busy looking for loopholes, basically. And he found one in his Bryn Mawr contract. And after a couple of years, he left because he was offered a job to teach at Wesleyan. And after a couple of years there, he got a job offer that was really the only one that was going to kind of satisfy that itch, that political itch. And for a number of years, it did just that. He got the call to come back to his alma mater and teach at Princeton. And that he did in 1890. What happened to Wilson at Princeton in the 1890s and into the turn of the century was really kind of fascinating because he became an indispensable member, not just of the school, but of the entire community. He was everywhere. I mean, he was starting the football team. He was organizing football plays and teaching them how to do that. He was running the Daily Princetonian. He was developing debating societies, parliamentary societies, anything. Wherever you turned around, Woodrow Wilson was not only starting a new organization, but writing a constitution for it. But then again, this is a boy who at 9 years old in Augusta, Georgia, started the Little League team and wrote a constitution for that. And I think it's probably the only Little League team in America to this day with its own constitution, written by Woodrow Wilson. Not bad, that, I say. So anyway, there is Woodrow Wilson, indispensable at Princeton, such that in 1902, the trustees of the university decided the place had really become a stagnant pond. Or as the then president of the school liked to say, I run the finest country club in America. And he did. And it was a beautiful country club, and it was great, and it was really for the sons of the very privileged. And Wilson and the trustees decided it is time for a change. In 1902, he became the president of Princeton unanimously and immediately. His successor was given a quick payoff and sent aside. And Wilson, over the next several years, transformed higher education in the United States. He began by changing the way we teach. If you went to a college in which you majored in something, in which there was a sequence of courses to your major, in which you perhaps took some electives outside of your major, in which you had two lectures and a class each week, a smaller group, in which maybe there was an honor code. All those are Wilsonian notions that he combined into what we call a college education. And that model exists to this day and is still the way most of us learned in school. Now, after he had done that, Wilson launched into this plan to redo the society of college, the social life at the college. And he really wanted to undo this system. It was an eating club system at Princeton, much like fraternities. But this system in which, again, the very wealthy could exclude Presbyterian ministers' sons, basically. And Wilson didn't like it, and he really began to institute some major, major changes. And this is the point where the trustees said, enough. We've had enough change. We love all this educational stuff that you've changed, but we rather like the system we've got. We sort of like this club, this country club. It's kind of nice here, and let's not spoil it. And indeed, Wilson was about to get the boot in 1910, when something all but literally fell from the heavens. And that was, he got another call. Now, this is a point, 1910, when New Jersey, and I don't want to offend any people who have crossed the river tonight, but New Jersey was considered, if you can imagine, the most corrupt state in the Union. And they had the most corrupt political machine in the Union, the Democratic machine. And they had this great plan. We need a puppet. Well, who can we go to? Well, why don't we go to that little professor in Princeton? Let's go to that college president who's making lots of headlines as being a kind of do-gooder and reformer. And isn't he great? Great for our image. And they offered him basically the governorship. They said, President Wilson of Princeton, if you run for the governorship, we can all but guarantee you will win that election. And how do you feel about that? And Wilson said that he would run, and he did, and he won in a landslide. And the very first thing he did within his first week of his inauguration was kick the machine out. I mean, literally, he banned them from the public buildings. Now, all eyes in America turn to New Jersey. Is that Secaucus I smell? You know? They turned Jerseyward, and indeed now the Democratic Party is thinking, we have a man here who is presidential timber. 1912 is almost upon us. We have a big jump ball of an election coming up. We have an unpopular President William Howard Taft, who's about to run for his second term. We have Theodore Roosevelt, his predecessor, who had picked Taft, who doesn't like what Taft has become, doesn't like what he's turned the Republican Party into. So Teddy Roosevelt is now saying, I think I'm going to bolt the party and start a new party, an independent party, the Bull Moose Party, the Progressives. And then there was going to be Woodrow Wilson running for the Democrats. Three-way race. It was an electoral college landslide for Wilson. And he ran on this great reform agenda, a very progressive agenda, that was called the New Freedom. And the New Freedom was largely about economic freedom. And here is, again, just one of those great points, one of those great junctions in which the personal life and the professional really meld. Because what economic freedom meant to Woodrow Wilson was a leveling of the playing field. And just the way he wanted to equalize society at Princeton, so he tried to do and actually succeeded by passing a very progressive agenda in just 18 months as governor of New Jersey. And so now he wants to do that with the United States of America. And he does that right out of the gate. I mean, he is hardly in office when he begins to introduce not only a number of incredibly progressive new initiatives, but an entirely new management style. He basically redefined the office of the presidency of the United States. And here's what he did. He came in with some big economic things to do right away. The first thing he wanted to do was tariff reform. He felt that was soaking the poor more than they should be. He believed in a graduated income tax, which would, again, level the field, make the rich pay a little more so that the poor had a chance to join a middle class. The wealth most of the wealth of this nation was in the hands of a very few people. And again, Wilson wanted to diffuse this, wanted to disperse money elsewhere. So these were just some of the very first things he did in his first few months in office. He introduced a Federal Reserve System. He thought there should be banks. There should be a dozen banks spread out across the country. Again, he's trying to take the power away from this monopoly, this banking trust that lived and worked out of New York. And Wilson thought, well, we could equalize things a bit more if we had these banks spread all over the country and being ready to give credit to Southerners and to Westerners. Well, this was a great and somewhat foreign notion. Wilson was soon putting the first Jew on the Supreme Court. Well, this was something of an outrage in the 19-teens. I mean, the Jews were still not part of American society. They were not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. So all these things were going on. Now, the way he did this was in that redefinition of what a president does. And it was his methodology that was so interesting. Wilson had a notion that the American government was kind of funny. He loved this country. He loved his Constitution, not even the one he didn't write. He loved, like, the real Constitution. But he tried to rewrite it as much as he could by working between the lines. I've often said Woodrow Wilson didn't really want to be the president of the United States. He wanted to be the prime minister. He wanted to be the leader that had a legislature all on his side, all behind him. And so in order to do that, he treated Congress almost as though it were Parliament and he were the prime minister. And the first way he did this was by appearing before the Congress very often. Now, presidents had not appeared in Congress in person since 1800, when John Adams left office. Presidents have always given State of the Union addresses. Let me rephrase that. They've always written State of the Union addresses. But after John Adams, the presidents didn't show up anymore. They would send a speech, and a clerk would read it to a joint session, and that would be that. The president didn't show up. Woodrow Wilson changed that. He became the first president to show up and deliver the State of the Union address. It's now obviously an American institution. Whenever Wilson had an important legislative measure he wanted to take up with the Congress, to take up with the American people, he called a joint session of Congress. 25 times, sometimes in the summer in Washington, Wilson called a joint session of Congress about tariff reform, about a Federal Reserve System, about an 8-hour workday, about workmen's compensation. All these things, all these progressive ideas, he was able to put across because he would give these speeches. And then he did something even more remarkable. He'd show up the next day. It wasn't just the theatrics, you see. He wasn't there just to give a showy speech. He was there to twist some arms. And there is, in the U.S. Capitol, a little-known room that no president used before Wilson and no president has used since. And it has a very complicated name. It's called the President's Room. And it sits there, and it's a gorgeous room. It's small, but beautiful tiles, colorful. It's just a magnificent little room. And it has a little desk, a couple of chairs, a couple of sofas. And Wilson used to show up there and use it for its designed purpose, which was to negotiate, to have conversations with the Senate and the House of Representatives, so that as people were walking off the Senate floor, Wilson would be sitting there in this room. He could see them. He would pick them off, and he would call them into his office, basically, and the old schoolmaster would sit them down and give them an old-fashioned lesson in U.S. government. And time again, these measures passed, and we had this incredibly progressive period, the most progressive agenda that had ever been passed, period. Now, after 4 years in office, or actually within that period, his beloved wife, after 1 year in office, his beloved wife Ellen, that girl he courted, with, by the way, thousands of love letters. And when I say thousands, I mean thousands of love letters. They get so gooey sometimes, I just had to take a walk. It was like, dude, you know, you said it. We got it. But these letters would go on for 15, 20 pages sometimes. And then 3 hours later, he's writing another one, you know? And finally, she married him, thank God. But even then, they were separated a lot because he was just writing letters all the time. Thousands of letters. But anyway, this beloved creature dies in the White House the week. I mean, you can't invent this stuff. The very week that World War I is breaking out. And there's a scene in the book where Woodrow Wilson is sitting there by her bedside, and he has one hand holding her dying hand, and the other hand, he's writing a letter to the Tsar, to the Kaiser, to the King of England, saying, please, you mustn't go to war. Here's what the United States is offering to do. And, well, boy, if ever you wanted to meld these two sides of a man, there they were, one on each hand. Incredible story. Well, by April of 1917, Wilson had been reelected on the slogan, he kept us out of war. But by April 2nd, 1917, we could not stay out of war any longer, he believed. And Wilson did what Wilson does. He called a joint session of Congress. And he gathered them there, and he declared that this country had to go to war, because the German militarism, their incredibly belligerent attitude, their constant torpedoing of neutral ships, American lives being lost, the revelation of the Zimmermann telegram that Germany was conspiring with Mexico, perhaps to take over the United States, all those things were caving in on him, and he delivered one of the greatest speeches in American history. And certainly a speech that has resounded in American foreign policy to this minute. And within that speech, there is one line that has been the foundation of American foreign policy ever since 1917. And here's the line. Most of you know it. It's the one thing you learned in high school about Woodrow Wilson. The world must be made safe for democracy. And that has been used and abused and misused interpreted, misinterpreted for the last 100 and how many ever years it has been. No, it hasn't even been that many, 90-something years. So that, you see, every time there is an American incursion anywhere in the world, whether it is Vietnam, whether it is possibly Syria, whether it is Afghanistan or Iraq, the roots of that, and very often the defense of that, is this is what Woodrow Wilson suggested. And in essence, he was saying, and this is again subject to great interpretation, case by case, but in essence, Wilson was asking this huge American question, which is, does the United States, with all its might, does it have or does it not have a certain moral responsibility to look out for other nations? Is there not, should there not, be a moral component to American foreign policy? Can we just sit here, for example, President Obama was asking 2 weeks ago, when we see a dictator gassing 1,000 of his own citizens and killing children? Well, is that not our business, or is it our business as human beings? Wilson contended in its purest form that this is part of our responsibility and that the world must be made safe for democracy. How that was meant to be instituted is wildly subjective and subject to great interpretation. But all that being said, we did go to war. Woodrow Wilson became commander-in-chief of the greatest mobilization the world had yet seen. Within a matter of a year and a half, he sent 2 million troops overseas. I'm not talking about a little army crossing the Hellespont. I am talking about 2 million men crossing the Atlantic Ocean. This was quite incredible. And it was, to go back to the personal side of Woodrow Wilson, this was extremely difficult for him. You know, if you read any other book of Woodrow Wilson, you will read the scene of his giving that speech, that immortal, the world must be made safe for democracy speech. What most books leave out is the moment after the speech. And to me, it just breaks me up every time I think about it, which is Wilson gave that powerful speech, tremendous applause. It just didn't stop in the Capitol. And then Wilson and his second wife, Edith, whom he met shortly after his first wife died, whom he wooed by writing hundreds of the most passionate love letters you've ever read, and married her. And anyway, Wilson and Edith drive in the car from Congress down Pennsylvania Avenue in silence back to the White House. Woodrow Wilson goes into his office, puts his head down on the table, and sobs. Sobs. One man saw him and said he sobbed like a baby. Now, this is a president, you see, who realized he had signed death warrants for 2 million men. And Wilson felt responsible for every one of them. And there's a scene later in the book where Wilson is at the American cemetery in Paris on Memorial Day of 1919 and gives a speech looking at the graves of these American soldiers and talking about how he basically condemned them all to their deaths. And in so doing, he takes a vow that he will fight to see that that never happens again. And the way he was going to ensure that that would never happen again was by writing the peace treaty. And so the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, left the country for 6 months. 6 months he was in Paris, during which time he enacted most of what he called his 14 points, the 14th of which was the establishment of something he called a League of Nations. This was something out of King Arthur, in a way. It was a concept of a round table in which every country would sit, in which nobody would sit at the head of that table. and they would decide matters of war and peace before war had broken out. Skirmishes would be discussed, and there would be something that we now call collective security. All the nations would contribute men who would then fight if one of the countries in the world violated the rules of the world, the rules of the League of Nations. This standing army would be there to go and rescue things. Well, Wilson came back from Paris with his treaty in hand. He had made some compromises along the way, but he got his League of Nations in there. All the countries signed off on it. It was unanimous approval of the League of Nations. One big problem: President of the United States doesn't ratify treaties. Only the United States Senate does. Only a very contentious, increasingly Republican Senate does. And Wilson came home and found opposition the likes of which he had not even imagined. And then he launched into what I think is the greatest crusade any president has ever embarked upon. Realizing the Senate wasn't going to pass this thing, he went on a 29-city tour around the country, selling it to the people. One speech at a time, sometimes five speeches a day. It was in the dead of a really hot summer of 1919, traveling in un-air-conditioned steel cars, train cars, that were basically like moving ovens. And there he was in very fragile health, more fragile than his doctor had even told him, who had not revealed the extent of his arteriosclerosis. And Wilson, indeed, a little better than halfway through that tour, collapsed. They rushed the train home. A few days later, Woodrow Wilson suffered a stroke. And now the story gets really good, because now what unfolds is the greatest conspiracy ever to occur in the White House. And that conspiracy is between Mrs. Wilson, who is rather uneducated, had the handwriting — well, you look at her letters, it looks like a 9-year-old wrote these things. I mean, it's everything but hearts above the eye, you know. A savvy woman in her way, and a tough woman in her way, but she and a few doctors conspired to keep the president's stroke from the world. Nobody knew about it, including the vice president, who was a bit of a bozo, named Thomas R. Marshall from Indiana. The rumor is that when they finally did tell him the president had suffered a stroke, the rumor in Washington was that he fainted. So even he felt not quite ready for prime time. But this conspiracy went on. Wilson could speak, he could think, but he was paralyzed on his left side. And as we now know, a century later, stroke victims suffer in other ways. There was great emotional oscillation. I mean, Wilson had these great mood swings. And in my going through his papers and retracing what was going on in Paris, I could see he was going through mood swings while, in fact, they were drawing up the treaty. But so it went. Wilson never got his league. The conspiracy continued for 18 months. Virtually nobody saw the President of the United States. This is crazy. I mean, you know, people ask me, how did this happen? I say, well, you know, Edith Wilson was not a big tweeter. She didn't Instagram. And so that, you know, you could do this in 1919, 1920, 1921. Wilson hobbled out of the White House, the lamest duck ever to leave office. He retired to Washington, D.C., the only president to do so. And indeed, within 3 years, he was dead. Shortly before he died, something kind of amazing happened. Warren Harding, perhaps the most crooked president, succeeded him. And day by day, people would go to Wilson's house in Washington on S Street. You can visit the house today. It's a wonderful museum. And there'd be 10 or 20 people out there on any given day. And then there'd be 100 people, maybe 200 people some days. On Veterans Day, November 11th, the day the armistice was signed, there were 10,000 people outside Wilson's door. The next year, 20,000 people. The little house on S Street, you see, became this shrine to peace, to freedom, to democracy, to idealism. And Woodrow Wilson gradually was resurrected bit by bit. I don't have time to get into why I think Woodrow Wilson's star has faded, but I think there are two very big reasons that I'll just give you the headline. One is the irony that this most progressive man, certainly one of the most progressive of the century, that he should have also introduced one of the most regressive policies in the history of the nation, and that was introducing Jim Crow segregation to Washington, which he did shortly after getting into office. He thought he was doing the right thing. He thought the country was not ready for integration. It's arguable either way, but it was certainly a backward move. There had been some motions forward for African Americans in this country, and Wilson clearly had set them back. Partly that Southern background, that personal story, partly political savvy. He knew he needed the Southern Senate behind him to get his new freedom passed. The other real strike against Woodrow Wilson is the fact that he became one of the most suppressive presidents in history by reintroducing the alien and sedition laws, which he did during the war. And people were sent to jail for expressing their thoughts, basically for free speech. But in the end, the life itself was something inspirational. And I think, again, whether you love him or hate him, whether you agree with him or disagree with him, he's undeniable. His influence, his presence in our daily lives, he's just there. Woodrow Wilson is part of us. His ideas, and even more than that, as Wilson used to say, one ideal is worth more than 20 ideas. Ideals are the pushing things in this world. Thank you very much. Thanks. Thank you. Now, listen. Thanks. Thank you. Now, I've left you precious little time to ask questions, but I'm happy to take some as long as we're allowed. You in the back, and I'm told there are microphones, and then we'll go to you in the back. So.
Hi, you mentioned about the resegregation of D.C.
Yes.
Could you just talk about a couple other aspects of Wilson's white supremacy?
Yes, and I'm a little hesitant to say white supremacy. Wilson, as I make quite clear, his statements, his thoughts, the way he judged a man who walked into a room, and the way he used the color of his skin to make a quick decision, that is certainly racist. No question about it. That being said, and I feel funny talking about gradations of racism, I don't believe he was a virulent racist. I call him in the book a genteel racist. In fact, he was very courtly, very gentlemanly, always kept his doors open to African Americans, in fact, more than any president had before him. And I'm not forgetting Theodore Roosevelt, who invited George Washington Carver to the White House. I'm sorry, Booker T. Washington, not George Washington Carver. George Washington Carver is busy with his peanuts. Booker T. Washington. But, you know, after that incident, T.R. never had Booker T. Washington back. That was the end of it, and he took a lot of heat for it. Wilson always did not have African Americans to dinner, but he always welcomed them into the White House, with one exception, one African American named William Monroe Trotter. Wilson found deeply insulting when he came to the White House, and Wilson threw him out and said, "Sir, you have just set back your cause by the way you have treated me, because I didn't treat you that way." Now, I give you what Trotter had said in that meeting, and I think Wilson overreacted. But many of the others who came were not just charmed by Woodrow Wilson, they were rather intrigued by his notion that Wilson believed there was going to be a revolution one way or the other, and I think he didn't want it on his watch. But more to the point, as he said, this country needs another generation or two before that kind of assimilation, that integration, can take place in this country. And he used to prove it. He said, "I'm from the South. I know." And I think he was saying, and I do take him at his word, he was not one of those people, but he knew enough Southerners who were going to make it absolutely impossible for African Americans to get through this thing peacefully. And Wilson already saw a number of incidents when blacks and whites were thrown into situations together. The biggest fear in Southern culture at that time was that a white woman might one day have to work for a black boss. This was beyond imagination. Wilson could not see that happening, at least on his watch. He knew what was going to happen was going to be quite terrible. Now, you know, the moment that I think was worst for Woodrow Wilson, and it could have been a great leadership moment for him, I think, but again, you know, his knowledge of the South in 1919 trumps us 100 years later. But it's interesting. I was reading an issue of Time magazine during Martin Luther King celebrations a few weeks ago, and Harry Belafonte made some comment about how all the black soldiers who came back from World War II thought this might be their moment to be integrated into society. They'd all shed their blood. They had gone to the front lines. They had done everything the white soldiers had done. So surely they had proved themselves as Americans. And what a disappointment it was to find that was not the case. Well, that was exactly what happened in 1919. When all the soldiers, and there were a number of black soldiers who were not only fought well, but really had the worst jobs in the war, in many cases were used as cannon fodder, and they came back thinking, aha, at last, this is the moment we can finally integrate society. And exactly what Woodrow Wilson was talking about occurred. And that was, it made the whites, especially the Southern whites, but I shouldn't limit this to the South, because riots broke out all over the country in the summer of 1919. It was so bloody, it's called the Red Summer. And it was a terrible, terrible time. It could very well be the lowest point of race relations in the United States. And it's also the moment, not by chance, the Ku Klux Klan really begins its great reascent. And this is the moment that the country became more racist than ever. Now, could Woodrow Wilson have stepped forward and said, this has got to stop? Maybe he could have, although he was shortly felled by a stroke. And indeed, his primary interest at that point was not race, it was getting this League of Nations passed. He thought that affected the whole world, not a pocket of the population of the United States. So it's a tricky question. I don't do speculative history. You know, I don't learn stuff by reading tea leaves. I can just read what was going on at the time. And whether I always agree with Wilson or not, I understand at least what his thinking was. And I can tell you this, and I think you'll feel this if you read the book, that Wilson was, in his day, a centrist. And even though here we are 100 years later looking at segregation, how can anybody be thinking segregation is acceptable? In 1913 up to 1920, this was actually considered a pretty good idea by a lot of people, including the Supreme Court that talked about separate but equal. And it was only occasionally Wilson got glimpses of the fact that things were separate, but they were not equal, in fact. In fact, the lavatories were different, the lunchrooms were different, riding on the bus was different. And he did nothing about that. So, you know, I think that's probably one of the two great strikes against him as a person, not just a leader. Now, we had someone back here.
Yes. Since we're in Philadelphia, may I ask you to comment upon a book about Wilson written in the 30s by a Philadelphia author with Sigmund Freud?
Ah, yes. About the book you're saying, but William Bullitt's book you're talking about? There was a rather brilliant Philadelphian, yes, named William S. Bullitt, who was a junior member of the great 18, the diplomats that went over to Paris. And Bullitt really was a great admirer of Wilson's. He believed in all the things Wilson went to Paris for and the 14 points and all that. Along the way, though, especially, and you'll see in the book, Wilson is suffering from something over there. I suggest he had a stroke or two. And there are certainly these great emotional scenes there that are kind of crazy when you think he's now deciding the fate of the world. But in making some compromise to get the treaty completed, Bullitt was completely, completely against Woodrow Wilson. He was very much disillusioned, and he finally just quit over one incident. He thought, actually, Lenin should have been recognized by Wilson and that we should have made greater overtures to Russia in that moment. And in Wilson's not doing that, Bullitt quit very loudly. And over the years, he had a friend named Sigmund Freud. And so Bullitt went to Freud and said, "Dr. Freud, if I give you the facts of Woodrow Wilson's life, do you think you could put him on the couch and shrink him?" And, well, he said it a little, you know. But Freud, who didn't like Woodrow Wilson, Freud being Austrian, and Austria didn't fare all that great in World War I, if you remember. And so he said, absolutely. And so they worked on this book together. And it is, well, I mean, whether you like Wilson or not, it's a nasty little book. Because, first of all, it is based on, quote, facts that this guy who hated Woodrow Wilson gave to Freud. So it's already built on a kind of shaky foundation, let's be fair. And then Freud does his number on it. Now, there was one thing that these two gentlemen decided, though. Because Mrs. Wilson outlived her husband, Freud and Bullitt decided, you know what? It is not proper to publish this book as long as Mrs. Wilson lives. Little did either of them know, Mrs. Wilson lived into the 1960s. and this is just one of those great moments of history. But when John F. Kennedy was inaugurated in January of 1961, there up on the platform in the third row was a little old lady. Nobody even knew who she was, but it was Mrs. Woodrow Wilson. It was Edith, first female president of the United States. And there she was, sitting next to Eleanor Roosevelt. They all knew who she was, but nobody had a clue who Mrs. Wilson was. And anyways, Mrs. Wilson died in 61 at the end of that year, on Woodrow's birthday, in fact. And the book was not published until 1965. And when it came out, actually most of the reviews said, this really tells us more about Sigmund Freud than Woodrow Wilson. So that was the role of it. And Bullitt, of course, went on. He had a rather good career in diplomatic service for much of his life under Roosevelt. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.